You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. How's it going? Microphone working all right? I'll turn it up a little. Okay. Welcome to the last lecture before the midterm. You hear me okay? All right, so I don't have too deep an agenda today. I'm essentially just going to cover very quickly all of the material from the first 3 weeks of class, which is everything that's covered on the midterm. And then I'll cover last quarter's midterm itself, which, of course, was the undergraduate midterm. Yours will be harder. But if we can get through the undergraduate midterm in an hour, then in half an hour, I'm sure we can get through something much harder in an hour. All right? So how's assignment one going? Pretty fantastically. So people have really put in the effort, gotten themselves on the leaderboard, won the glory for themselves, is baseline here, and wishes to reveal themselves. Maybe they want to keep a low profile. Okay, so they're the current leader. I think you can guess what their solution consists of. So get started. The homework related to this assignment will be on the course webpage tonight. I'm sure everyone's very keen to get started on homework three already. Okay, the midterm itself is going to be this time on Monday, 6:40 to 7:40 p.m. It's closed book, so you can't bring in any cheat sheet. If you look at last quarter's midterm, the last page has a bunch of pseudocode and definitions and stuff. It should be enough to get you through all of the questions, so that should really be all you need. You shouldn't have to, I mean, if you look at last quarter's midterm, you'll see that you shouldn't have to memorize too much stuff. It's more about applying the algorithms correctly. I'll do a few extra office hours tomorrow morning if you're interested and you're up early enough, and TAs will have regular office hours on Friday too. Okay, so first 3 weeks, what did we have? We had regression, we had classification, and we had dimensionality reduction. Really, we had various types of supervised and unsupervised learning. So regression, classification, they were both examples of supervised learning. PCA, clustering, community detection, these are all examples of unsupervised learning. Essentially, all of these algorithms are trying to come up with good models for our data in order to solve some problem. So what does this sentence really mean if we expand it out? It means we have some well-defined objective we're trying to solve, some measurement associated with whether a model is good or not, which could be minimizing a mean squared error, optimizing some classification accuracy, or compressing data with as little information loss as possible. So we have some very objective measure whether the model is working well or not, or given two models, we have a very objective measure of which one of them is better, and we have some data that can be used to solve this task. So in the case of these problems like regression and classification, what that means is that we have features that we think are likely to be associated with the output variable we're trying to predict. And then all of these models are just trying to say which features are useful for optimizing our given objective as accurately as possible. That's what learning algorithms consist of. So in the case of supervised learning, we're trying to estimate this relationship between input and output variables very directly. We're trying to say which features are positively or negatively correlated with a given output variable, and that gives rise to things like regression and classification. With unsupervised learning, the goal is maybe not so clear. So we set it up in terms of ideas like compression, but really we have some bunch of techniques that are good at finding useful features. So we cast it as sort of compression algorithms, where we want to take high-dimensional data and find a small number of dimensions that lose as little information as possible. But really, the use of these things is to say, well, we'd like to come up with good features of very, very high-dimensional data, like an adjacency matrix with billions of edges or features with thousands and thousands of dimensions. We'd like to find useful features or useful structure in the data that could be used to solve some other predictive task. Okay, so first off, linear regression, we're assuming is a very simple predictor of this form. You should be able to solve this for theta pretty easily. Where we're just assuming a linear relationship between the features and the parameters that predicts the output variable very directly. Okay, so all of this time we were trying to minimize something like the mean squared error. This notation shouldn't be too scary by now, or you're just trying to say, I'd like to choose my parameters such that the predictions made by the model are as close to the labels as possible in the mean squared sense. We saw why this was a reasonable thing to do in the sense that if you assume that your model's errors are normally distributed, you'll be able to figure out that the mean squared error is the correct thing to optimize. We did a bit of feature representation, so this is certainly something that shows up on the midterm. How do you come up with good features to represent a given quantity? Like if you wanted to say something like rating is somehow related to the, offset term plus theta times month, how could you incorporate the month into this expression in a useful way? So kind of naively saying something like January equals 1, December equals 12. We saw how this kind of naive representation of various types of features is not going to work. You would just learn that people's ratings go up as we get to the later months of the year, or they go down as we get to the later months of the year. And then there's kind of this sawtooth where everything has to wrap back around. So this would presumably not be a very realistic way of capturing the relationship between the months of the year and the rating. Basically, this sort of simple linearity assumption we're making is not a correct one. So how can we represent the month of a year so as to capture the fact that it changes in some non-linear way? And the solution we kind of came up with was to say that, you know, January would be 1000000000000. I think that's right. November would be 0000000000001, and December would be just 0, right? Can you remember why we did it this way rather than using a 12-dimensional representation? You get rid of one dimension. I mean, why do you want to get rid of one dimension? Yeah, it's redundant. I mean, in terms of the trivial solution to this problem, where we had X transpose X inverse, having redundant dimensions was really very harmful. So if you have features that are linear combinations of each other, so one feature can be expressed in terms of the other features you have available, then this kind of equation wouldn't be solvable. You would have a non-invertible matrix. What that means in a more intuitive sense, or what's really happening in a more intuitive sense, is that there are multiple equally good solutions to your problem, all of which are sort of indistinguishable from each other. So you could add weight to one feature and subtract the same amount of weight for whatever linear combination of features makes up that feature. And all of those solutions would be equally good. There'd be no unique best theta, which is essentially why this matrix is uninvertible. So we wanted to throw away a redundant dimension just so that we would have a unique identifiable solution with the basic version of that problem. So, yeah, a couple of things we had to think about when designing good features. We don't want the features to be redundant, and we want them to capture the actual likely shape of the function, which may be nonlinear. In this case, it was the month versus the rating, is now going to look, I don't know, something like this. Whatever. I forget what it actually looked like. It's some kind of, and this drawing is just terrible. It's going to be some kind of step function, right? So we can sort of approximately capture some kind of nonlinear or seasonal behavior with this type of feature representation. Okay, next thing we got onto is this idea of Occam's razor, So this is another way of dealing with some features that are redundant and choosing between seemingly equally good models, basically saying that if multiple models look equally good, one. So this expression amongst competing hypotheses, we should select the one with the fewest assumptions. Really here, a hypothesis is just a set of parameters. The one with fewest assumptions is kind of the model with the lowest complexity. So we came up with some different definitions of complexity. We would say a theta that looks all over the place is somehow more complex than a theta with just a small number of active dimensions. And also, similarly, it's more complex than a theta where the values are sort of close to uniform, except for maybe a few. Yeah, so we came up with two definitions of complexity. We'd say, without having enough information to fit this very complicated model, my sort of null hypothesis would be not many features are active, so only a few features are related to the output variable. Or my other hypothesis could be a simple model is one where every feature is about equally related to the output variable, unless I have enough information to conclude otherwise. And we came up with some proof that said, well, this corresponds to minimizing the L2 norm, this corresponds to minimizing the L1 norm, which was maybe a bit hand-wavy. I mean, the point is not to rederive that, but just to say how, given some model, we can add this additional term so as to penalize for complexity. And this gives you this sort of regularized optimization problem, which we're always going to be looking at for the rest of the class, where you have, you know, to some extent you want the error to be low, but to another extent you want the model to not be too complex. And you need to somehow trade off these two effects. How much lower should the error get before I'm willing to tolerate a more complicated model? And that was the role of a validation set, right? We said, what I really want is not a model that works well on the data it's been trained to work on, which is the training set. What I want is a model that's going to generalize well to new data. So that's the role of the validation set. If you're trying to choose how should I optimally set this trade-off so that my model will generalize to new data, you'll just hold out some data and run the model on the held out data. Okay, so that's one purpose of a validation set, but more broadly, the validation set is there to choose between models or to choose between any parameter values that are not directly part of your optimization procedure. So if you want to say, oh, is a k-means representation of my data better than a PCA representation of my data, use a validation set. If you wanted to say, is k-means with 10 clusters better than k-means with 20 clusters, it's not just the reconstruction error that matters. What really matters is how well it works for whatever predictive task you care about. That's what you use a validation set to test. So all of those kinds of decisions about your model, that's what the validation set is there for. And we saw these cute kind of plots of lambda between, say, 0 and 10,000, where here you're penalizing complexity. And here you're penalizing error. And we'll kind of have our naive model on the top, which is predicting the average all the time. And as you increase lambda, you're going to monotonically increase the training error. I mean, assuming all of your objective functions and your optimization procedures and your data is well formed. But for the validation error on your held out data, you're going to have this sort of sweet spot. This pen. So this is kind of the value of lambda you want to choose. That's going to represent how well your model generalizes to new data. So we came up with a few various theorems about the relationship between training validation and test sets and training validation and test errors. For instance, you know, as lambda increases, the training error should increase. As you're penalizing complexity more, you're favoring more naive models. The validation and test error should be as large as the training error. That's also making some assumptions about your data. You're assuming that your training and validation, so your testing and validation sets are independent of your training set, and they're drawn from the same distribution. And yeah, hopefully we have this nice sweet spot which you can use to balance between under and overfitting. And it'll also tell you, well, if I don't have that sweet spot, maybe if I only have a curve shape like this, maybe my regularizer is set too high. If I only have a curve shape like this, maybe my regularizer is set too low. Okay, that's week one. Are you happy with week one? Seems so long ago now, doesn't it? All right, week two. In week two, we moved on from regression to classification. So we were essentially looking at the same kind of tasks or the same kind of data and features, but binary or categorical versions of those things. So whereas we would look at something like rating prediction in week one, we'd want to look at purchase prediction or click prediction in week two, or even something like predicting a categorical output. So we saw a pretty naive way of doing it, but we saw how you could take some categorical prediction, like what animal is this? We could say, well, there's a finite set of animals. We can train a binary predictor for every single one. And then to turn our binary predictor into a multi-class predictor, we could just take whichever one of those binary predictors was most confident, or if there could be multiple animals in the image, we'll just take every one of those predictors that returns true. All right? So essentially, we can solve these sort of categorical or multi-class prediction tasks just by having a series of good binary predictors. All right, and we use this in the homework for things like categorization of text documents. So with linear regression, we assumed this type of simple relationship between, this sort of very direct relationship between the features and the parameters and the output variables. It was just this simple linear function. Whereas with binary classification tasks, we're trying to have an output variable which is true or false or a category. And the way we would do that is to say, I'm still going to use this kind of linear function, but I'm going to threshold it at some point, you know, as opposed to the previous form, which is y equals xi dot theta. All right, so we're still estimating this linear prediction function, which essentially says, does a particular feature make me more likely or less likely to think that the label is true if I observe that feature? We're just replacing this sort of direct output by a thresholding function. And really, we saw these three algorithms for classification. There are just three different ways of choosing theta. So these are all three different ways of adding up the influence of different features in order to predict some binary output. We're just saying, by making different assumptions about how the features relate to each other, we can find different algorithms to choose theta. So we had naive Bayes with a very simple independence assumption. We saw some problems with that, so we came up with logistic regression. We saw some problems with that, so we came up with SVMs. The full story was a bit more subtle, of course, but naive Bayes was like this very, very simple counting-based model. We're just making this conditional independence assumption. So if you don't remember what that is, it's the same as regular independence. There's a conditional variable afterwards. So rather than saying two variables are independent if they can be decomposed into their products, you're saying two variables can be decomposed into their product if we observe some third variable. So essentially, that's like an explanatory variable. We're saying, yes, there may be a relationship between two features, like whether a book mentions wizards and witches, but that can be explained by the category of the book, and they become independent once you observe the categories. That's a bad example because it's actually not conditionally independent. I guess the one I gave in class was whether I bring an umbrella is conditionally independent of whether the streets are wet, given that it's raining. So obviously the streets being wet and me bringing an umbrella are related concepts, but they're both explained by this explanatory variable of whether it's raining or not. And once you observe that, the two things become independent. What that means in terms of a classifier is that we can develop a very, very simple counting-based solution to classification. So if you want to solve something like P of Y given X, so it's the probability of some label given some set of features, Well, first of all, we can apply Bayes' rule, which says this looks like P of Y, P of X, given Y divided by P of X. And according to the naive Bayes assumption, we would be able to decompose this term. So this term depends on some very complicated combination of features. We're really saying, oh, each of those features is independent given the label. So this looks like probability of the label times each individual feature, probability of Xi given the label divided by probability of X. All right, so why this is useful is we now have an expression that only depends upon one feature and the label at a time. So we can very easily compute all of these expressions just by simple counting. Okay, and well, this expression is still getting in the way, which depends on all of the features. But really what we care about is this expression larger if the label is true, or is it larger if the label is false? That's what's going to determine whether we make a positive or a negative prediction. So we care about the ratio of this term with Y being true to this term with Y being false. And then the denominator actually cancels out when we compute the ratio. So that would look like P of not Y times the probability of I, P of Xi given not Y. All right, so what we really care about is whether that's greater than 1. That's what's going to determine how we make predictions with a naive Bayes classifier. All right, pretty elegant, pretty simple. Possibly badly motivated if your conditional independence assumptions are somehow violated. So we thought about this type of example where, you know, what if we tried to naively apply what the naive Bayes assumption is essentially doing to a regular linear regression model? We said, okay, I've got a linear regression model that depends on one feature. Like I'll say the number of pages in a book is some constant plus an offset for whether it mentions wizards. Maybe fantasy books are much longer than non-fantasy books or something like that. And I had another linear regressor that depended on a different function. What the naive Bayes assumption is doing is essentially saying, well, I could just combine these two things by adding together their coefficients. All right? And with a regular regression model, you can see why, if these features are related to each other in terms of how they impact the label, you can't do that. So this would say the number of pages of a book that mentions both wizards and witches is much, much higher than a book that just mentions one of the two. But really, it's the same thing. They're both just fantasy books. So if we trained a regular regression model, it would do the right thing. It would say, well, I'm either going to put all of the weight in wizards, or I'm going to put all the weight in witches, or I'm going to somehow balance the weight between the two, depending on how we regularize the model. So that's what regression does, linear regression does, that naive Bayes doesn't. So what we wanted was some way of fixing naive Bayes so that it would exhibit the same virtues that regular linear regression does, and just learn not to take two copies of an equivalent feature. So we said, okay, well, linear regression is using this input variable to predict some output variable with a linear function. Let's just say if we can convert that to a probability. And we use the sigmoid function to do that. So this is some function that's going to take the value 0.5 when xi dot theta is 0. It's going to approach 1 as xi dot theta gets very large, and it's going to approach 0 as xi dot theta is very negative. So this can now be interpreted as the probability of y given x equals sigmoid xi dot theta. All right, so that's how we would try and come up with the classification version of regression. And now we have this sort of probabilistic model, which we can write down for linear regression specifically, where we say, across all of my data, I would like, for those things that are labeled true, the probability should be as large as possible. For those things labeled false, the probability should be as small as possible. This gives me a likelihood of any given model, and I can try and choose my model parameters such that this likelihood is maximized, such that my model is best according to the data. And yeah, we came up with some scheme for doing this. You're given your objective. You'll take the log of the objective. You'll subtract a regularizer from the objective. It's not step one, still at step two. You'll take the derivative of the objective with respect to the parameters, and you'll climb the hill. That's how we would optimize a logistic regression function. And yeah, it's kind of finickety to go through the calculus of doing so. I'm not going to make you do that on the midterm, of course, but really what we have is this nice general principle that says if you can write down a likelihood associated with your data, given a set of model parameters, then you have this very general purpose optimization scheme where you can just say, okay, throw in a regularizer, differentiate, do hill climbing. So logistic regression is one sort of the simplest specific instances, but really something that shows up a lot in this class is this idea of a probabilistic model for some task. If you can write it down as a probability, then you always have a mechanism that looks like this one to solve the problem. Okay. That was logistic regression. It solved some problem that Naive Bayes had. It still has some problem, which is that, maybe it's a more subtle one now, is that we're letting every point vote, even the ones that don't need to vote because they're very easy to classify. So if you have some data set that consists of millions and millions of very easy to classify points and a tiny number of very hard to classify points, then the logistic regressor is going to let the easy to classify points outweigh the votes or the influence of the difficult to classify ones. So all of these negative examples want the boundary to be as far away as possible on the negative side. All of the positive examples want the boundary to be as far away as possible on the positive side. These points also want the same thing. They're unhappy to have been incorrectly classified, but their influence is outweighed by all of these easy to classify points. So what we kind of like to do is to say, can we come up with a version of this model or a version of linear classification such that once a point is confidently, correctly classified, it just says, okay, I'm done. I'll let the difficult points determine the solution. And that's what SVMs tried to give us. Logistic regressors weren't paying any special attention to the difficult instances, and they were kind of getting poisoned by the easy ones. So we want a classifier that optimizes directly the number of misclassifications rather than this probabilistic function. And that's what SVMs would give us. I won't go through the derivation again. But essentially we said, given some classification boundary, I'd like the points to either side of it to be on the correct side of it, of course, but I'd like them to be as far away from it as possible. So then it's really these points that are nearest to the boundary that determine what the classifier looks like. These points just say, well, I'm sufficiently confidently correctly classified, I don't need to influence the solution any further. So this was the simple case where there exists a perfect solution. We came up with a sort of relaxed version of that where there is no perfect classifier that says it's going to be okay for some points to be incorrectly classified as long as they're not incorrectly classified by too much. So you can go through the slides with a complicated version. The point is not really to rederive logistic regression or SVMs or anything. The point is to understand under what conditions should you apply each of these models. So they're all solving exactly the same task, binary prediction using a linear decision function that says which features are relevant or which features make us more likely to think the label is positive or negative. And they're making different assumptions to do so. They all have their advantages and disadvantages. I guess the only advantage of Naive Bayes is that it's trivial, right? Which is, it's a virtue. It's a gift to be simple or whatever. You can apply Naive Bayes very efficiently on very, very large data sets, which maybe is harder to do for SVMs or logistic regression. And of course, if this assumption is valid, then it's going to be just as good as the other models. If the assumption is not valid, you need something like logistic regression to solve this double counting issue. And then logistic regression itself has this more subtle problem that SVM somehow try to address. So knowing which one to apply when is really the relevant part of classification as far as the midterm is concerned. Yeah? Good question. Not sure if anyone has an answer to that that's particularly satisfactory. I mean, in general, SVM is assuming a very specific linear decision function. If you had some other complicated nonlinear features, you can easily write down a likelihood associated with Lidschrodt regression. You can do the hill climbing step in the same direction. The same kind of tricks do not necessarily apply to SVMs. Yeah, I mean, you always have a way of expressing the likelihood, I think. It's a reasonably broad set of models. SVMs are working for a more restricted class of functions. I don't know if anyone has a better answer to when you'd use Lidschrodt regression over SVMs. If so, let me know. That's my feeling. I mean, it's also just in terms of what the computational complexity of these things are as well. I mean, I think it goes this way, right? Okay, so we made these choices between various classifiers, and the second part of what we did in week two is to say, how can we evaluate classification algorithms in kind of non-standard settings? Everything we've been optimizing so far is just basically trying to minimize some binary classification error. How many things did you get wrong versus how many things did you get right? That may be insufficient in the event that there's, say, a very large class imbalance. Say you want to predict things that I'm going to click on versus things that I'm not. There's a tiny, tiny fraction of the data that I would click on and a huge fraction of the data that I wouldn't click on. So just counting all of the mistakes you make is not the right thing. What you really want is an algorithm that successfully recommends some things that I would click on, and if you recommend a bunch that I wouldn't as well, that's not so costly. So you want to sort of focus more on the positive things that I would click on rather than the huge number of things that I would not click on. Same sort of idea if you have this sort of X-ray example where making a mistake in one direction is just a nuisance, making the mistake in the other direction is disastrous. So basically you want to penalize false positives and false negatives differently. Yeah? I mean, nothing's particularly the best. I think with all of them you would have to modify the objective you're optimizing. So the way I suggested doing this in class is if you want to modify your algorithm to solve this, is that you would balance the weight between the positive and negative examples. So what I did in the slides was with Lidschrodt regression, but you can do exactly the same thing for SVMs, where you say I'm going to put a weight on the positive examples, which is 1 divided by the number of positive examples, and a weight on the negative examples, which is 1 divided by the number of negative examples. And then the two things are perfectly in balance. And that would be like SVMs or the Lidschrodt regression, that was optimizing the balanced error rate. Yeah, so I mean, there's the question of how you evaluate these models when you have these sort of non-standard settings, and there's the question that you're asking of how you actually optimize the models so as to be best for these evaluation criteria. Okay, so we had the other one where you wanted to penalize maybe false positives much more than you penalize false negatives. All the way around, perhaps. And the third case is where you only care about the most confident predictions. So you might want to evaluate these type of algorithms and how they rank things. So if you're trying to run a search engine or something where your goal is to say, give me a few queries that I think are most likely to be, sorry, a few pages that are most likely to be relevant to a particular query, you don't really care about whether the model successfully predicts relevant or irrelevant. All you care about is for those things it believes are most likely to be relevant, the ones that it's most confident about, some of those should be relevant. So you'd like to come up with an optimization criteria that achieves that. So yeah, we came up with various notions like the true positives, false negatives, that we can come up with measurements of these to evaluate classifiers. Basic things that we've been doing up until then, we're just counting the number of things we got correct divided by the number of things, or counting the number of things we got incorrect divided by the number of things. And we said, okay, that's somehow insufficient. We want algorithms that treat different types of mistakes differently, or which take confidence into account. Okay, so I won't go through all of those. That's something to look at in your own time, but we saw things like the balanced error rate to correct this class imbalance. We saw this idea like the F beta score, if you want to assign a different weight to false positives or false negatives. We saw, what else did we see? We saw the precision and the recall at the top K. So if your classifier or your ranking function has a fixed budget for how many pages you can return or something like that, you can evaluate it in terms of how many things did it get right amongst the top K, and how many of the total relevant things did it find amongst the top K. So that's really the take home from week two. You want to understand under which conditions, or what are the strengths and weaknesses of these various different classifiers, and also how do you evaluate them. So if I give you data where I say, all right, the class is very imbalanced, errors are much more costly in one direction, or I care about optimizing some kind of ranking objective, you should be able to say, all right, what evaluation measure should I be using in that case? All right, week two. We happy with week two? Are we powering through here? Okay, I better speed things up a little bit. Okay, so week three, dimensionality reduction. We were trying to compress high-dimensional data by making this assumption that it lies on a low-dimensional manifold. So really that means is that even though it's very high-dimensional, I can find some low number of dimensions which to represent it such that I would be able to reconstruct the data accurately, whether that means that I can reconstruct an original feature matrix in terms of the MSE, or whether it means I can find some small number of topics that describes the words people use in documents, or whether it means I can find a small number of communities that allow me to accurately reconstruct an adjacency matrix. All right, so the first thing we saw was just principal component analysis, which is making this one particular kind of low-dimensional manifold type of assumption, which says there are a few dimensions that explain a lot of variance in the data and a few dimensions that do not explain much variance in the data. So if you can find those dimensions, then you can just keep the high-variance ones, throw away the low-variance ones. And really what PCA is about is it's an algorithm to automatically find those dimensions for your data so that you can minimize this reconstruction error, so that you can discard those dimensions that cost you the least. And we saw how it can do cool things like find that something like an image patch can be described in terms of a few simple properties. So even though there are 27 dimensions that describe the colors of the 9 pixels of a 3x3 image, you can basically just say, well, how bright is it? How blue is it? How green is it? How much does it have vertical and horizontal gradients? And how much does it have vertical, diagonal, and horizontal edges? That's just 8 questions rather than 27. But that's going to describe pretty much all of the realistic behavior you would have in natural images, right? Asking how much it varies along these dimensions doesn't really add anything. So it's a very natural way of compressing data by just finding which dimensions or which questions are relevant to ask. Okay, so, I mean, we went through this in class, of course, but essentially we came up with this sort of eigenvector-based solution. I actually did prove it this quarter. I should say we did prove this, where we showed that if you want to find the dimensions that are so that you can discard some of them on minimizing the mean squared error, you want to take the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix or whatever. I mean, you can go through that derivation. That's not going to be something relevant to the midterm. What's really relevant is knowing, given some data set like this one, where the PCA is the relevant algorithm to apply. And if not, why not? So this is some data where it's not relevant because there is no dimension that has more variance than any other dimension. If we tried to throw away some dimension of this data, we're going to lose half the information no matter what dimension we discard. So we came up with these clustering algorithms, which are a way of finding different kind of low-dimensional structure, which essentially corresponds to something like locality in the data. Okay, so I won't go through all of these. Just I'll mention what we saw. We saw k-means, which essentially is trying to find a bunch of centroids such that you can replace each point just by its sort of centroid membership. And we saw some greedy algorithm to approximately find good centroids. And we also saw the case of hierarchical features, which these are the kind of things you'd have if you wanted to model like profile attributes on Facebook or something. There's the attribute of which country you live in, the attribute of which city you live in, the attribute of which school you go to, the attribute of which department you're part of, or which classes you're in. And as you get more and more specific, the specific features determine the values of the more general ones. So that's an example of a hierarchical feature. Okay, so maybe you'd like to find clusters that say what information should be shared between nodes. Like this node and this node, they don't have the specific features in common, but they do have the more general feature in common, whatever that is. So you'd like to automatically discover those hierarchies from the data. And yeah, we gave an algorithm for doing that too, which just gradually merges clusters together. That was it for clustering. Final thing we saw was community detection, where we'd like to, yeah? I mean, the short answer is just pick one. Yeah. If it's really two pairs that are distinct, that have the same distance, if you merge this one and then merge this one, it's the same as merging this one and then merging this one. Yeah, if you had something like this, then you can end up with this solution, or you could end up with this solution. Sorry, I'm using the blackboard. It won't be preserved for posterity. But yeah, I think just choose arbitrarily between them, which is why I suggested doing that in the homework. Yeah. I mean, I guess if the distances are equal, you have no reason a priori to think that these points are more similar to these points than these points are similar to these points. So it's a tie. I mean, you have to break the tie somehow. Yeah, I think certainly in this case, you're not going to be able to use a non-greedy algorithm. There are going to be combinatorially many ways if there are lots and lots of ties, there'd be many, many, many ways you could do this. Yeah, you could write down an objective that says, okay, I want to minimize some reconstruction error. I'd like to find my hierarchy such that is done, but I don't think you're going to be able to come up with a better solution than the greedy algorithm to do it. Okay, anyway, just to quickly finish up, we saw a few algorithms for community detection. We had this idea of connected components, which was somehow too coarse-grained in real networks. So maybe we wanted to find something like a cut that says, well, this network is really one component, but it's almost like it's two separate groups. Can we discover those groups automatically by finding a point where not too many edges are cut? And we saw ratio cuts and normalized cuts that make two different assumptions. One is that in ratio cuts, the two groups should be about equally sized. And in normalized cuts, the two groups should have about equally many edges, or the nodes should have equal degrees, or the sets should have equal influence or something like that. And finally, we saw clique percolation, which is just trying to move away from this idea of clusters being totally adversarial objects and saying, well, maybe we can have a community detection algorithm that finds overlapping sets of nodes. which we'll do by finding tiny little cliques, saying that they're micro communities and merging them if they have some almost cliques in common. All right, so that's it for week three. I mean, we have clustering and community detection. So you should know, like, for clustering algorithms, when is it appropriate to apply one given some data versus another. And if I gave you some graphs, you'd be able to run these various community detection algorithms on them and determine which of them was appropriate for that type of graph. Okay, so that's it. I'll go through the actual practice midterm now. The format for this Monday's midterm is going to be very similar. It's going to have the same types of sections. It's going to have some regression, classification, dimensionality reduction, community detection, feature design, whatever you like. It's going to be harder, of course. I mean, for one, this is a graduate class. That was an undergrad exam. So two, you have a practice exam to work from. Three, I just made it too easy. So, you know, everyone was getting marks above 90%, which is something we just can't have. So it's going to be harder, not that much harder. I'm sure if you can do the past exam, you'll be fine. Essentially, I wrote something like 35 marks worth of questions. I discarded the 10 hardest from the undergrad exam, and I discarded the 10 easiest from the grad exam. So, you know, it'll be easy. It'll be fine. Okay, so what was this very easy midterm? Has anyone done it yet? No? Okay, well, we'll do it now. So the first type of question, which, I mean, you're going to see something like this. It's going to be a feature design question. You have some micro data set where you have some variable you want to predict, like the rating, and you have some features you're trying to do that with. In this case, it's going to be whether it takes reservations, whether it has takeout, and how expensive is it. So, okay, I mean, some of these questions, you can really see that they are too easy, right? I'd never written a midterm before, and I learned a lot from this experience myself. What's the average rating? 4.5. Is anyone stuck on that question? All right. So what's the mean squared error? Okay, we'll just add up the deviations. There's only two of them. So half squared plus a half squared divided by 5 equals a tenth. Still happy? Okay, so here's the sort of most trivial feature design question you could imagine. We'd like to say, what's the feature matrix that we'd like to use to solve this problem? I've given away what my representation is, and you've just got to fill in the blanks. So obviously we have the ratings, 5, 4.5, 4, 4.5. So the first has to be the offset. And then I've somehow converted, it's not too mind-blowing, I've converted takes reservations and takeouts from binary values to numbers. Okay, so I'll just power through this. I'm sure anyone can tell me if they're stuck. All right. And yeah, I mean, I understand the difference between a label, a feature, and parameter, so they're even there in the correct order in the question for you. All right. There'll be something like this. It will not be this easy. Some quick questions about interpretation of features. This was actually a bit on the ambiguous side for people, but, you know, what does it mean for theta naught to be 7? Can someone give me a sentence that says what it means? So the kind of wrong answer would be average, right? We didn't want to see this. The average rating is not 7 out of 5. We did see that a little bit. Offset is also not a great answer. I mean, yes, it is the offset, but how do you interpret an offset like that? I mean, it's what we would expect the rating to be if all other features could have been 0. You're extrapolating. I mean, your price is also between like $1 sign and $4 sign. So if you could hypothetically have a $0 sign restaurant that gave you free food, the rating could be 7. I think that's pretty reasonable. I guess the more interesting one is, you know, what's the interpretation of theta 3 equals negative 1? I mean, can you give me a sentence? The feature is negative, but I mean, in more detail, you'd say if the price goes up by $1 sign, the rating goes down by $1 sign. So price up by dollar sign, rating down by 1. Okay, so a unit change in the feature corresponds to a theta 3 change in the output variable. All right. What next? So we wanted to represent something slightly more complicated. How would you encode whether a restaurant has takeout into... not has takeout, sorry. How would you incorporate, what was it, good for, into your predictor? It's now a categorical variable, so we've got to think a little bit more about how we would encode it. Maybe the not-so-good way would be to say, okay, well, breakfast, I'll call that 1. Lunch, I'll call that 2. Brunch is in between breakfast and lunch, right? So brunch equals 1.5. Now, this would be the sort of wrong way of solving the problem. I mean, I don't think it's a very hard trap to avoid. Really, you'll want to come up with some kind of binary representation. What do you have? Breakfast, brunch, lunch, dinner, and you'd say, okay, the first one is 1000, the second one is 0010, 0100, 0011, 0001. There's a reasonable answer. So something like that. You may have to think a bit harder how you come up with a good representation, though. Okay, that was sort of it for feature engineering. The next questions were about how would you do sort of model selection. So given that you're trying to minimize this regularized mean squared error, where you're choosing some fixed set of regularization hyperparameters, how would you choose the best model on this data? Lambda equals 1. So yeah, you'd pick the one that minimizes the validation error. Sort of a few wordy sort of questions. What does the validation set do? You use it to choose amongst models or choose among hyperparameters. How does training error vary with lambda? We covered that in the slides, of course. What is meant by underfitting or overfitting? And can you point to those in the plot? You know, underfitting, you penalized complexity too much. Overfitting, you penalized minimizing the error on the training set too much. Okay, so I don't think we wanted anything more complicated than that. Yeah? All right, so this is the first sort of fun question. I thought this would be a hard one for people. I stole it from someone else's lecture notes from a few years back, which I didn't think I'd get caught doing, but then somebody thought, oh, this is a fun practice problem that they'd post to Piazza the night before the midterm. So everyone did it, and everyone got it right. So I won't use that again. But, you know, it's a problem that requires you to think a little bit about the relationship between training and validation error and penalizing model complexity. So you kind of have to decide amongst which of these models is best, but you've only observed some of the training and validation errors. So you want to choose amongst these models the one with the minimal validation error. Do you have enough information to do so? So what can we say about this value? Yeah, it's the validation error, so it should be greater than the training error. I mean, assuming we did everything correctly, or blah, 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 this will be greater than 23. What can we say about this one? Greater than 25. What can we say about this one? So this is greater than 23 as well. In this case, because We increase the value of the regularization parameter, so we're penalizing complexity more. We're going to increase the training error. And if that's greater than 23, then this must also be greater than 23. Therefore, 18.32 is our best. It's our lowest validation error. Okay. Not too shocking. All right, some simple classifier evaluation. I mean, we had some simple, really silly classifier that just says, I'm going to classify a book as being fantasy if it mentions the words sorcerer, blood, knights, moon, or storm. So the only two of these books that would not be classified as fantasy would be A Book of the Sword, A History of Daggers, and The Remains of the Day, right? So we can say what's the true positive rate, what's the true negative rate, what's the false positive, what's the false negative. What's the true positive? We classified every fantasy book as being a fantasy book, right? So 5 out of 5. So 5 true positives. How many true negatives? Both of the things we classified as being negative are negative, so 2. How many false positives? None, I guess. No, there are a few false positives, aren't there? We classified this as being a fantasy book. We classified this and this as being fantasy. There's 3 false positives. There are no false negatives. Okay, so we can give you the true positive rate, the true negative rate, and the balanced error rate. The true positive rate, I basically give away for free, so it's just 5 on 5 plus 0 equals 1. The true negative rate is the number of true negatives divided by true negatives plus false positives. So that's equal to 2 on 5. And then the BER is just equal to the average of those two. Okay. That's the answer to that question. I mean, some more open-ended stuff after that. Can you say something good about naive Bayes logistic regression in support vector machines? I'm sure you can all come up with something nice to say about them. That's earlier on in the slides today. Okay, so a bit of community detection and clustering. Just running some basic community detection algorithms. Certainly, I have found hard to come up with examples where there is unambiguously a correct solution, but it's also not obvious. So I think sometimes here it's just a bit on the obvious side. We have some connected components. What does ratio cut give us? I had something. Same, yeah. Click percolation with k=3, I guess, is a bit more non-obvious. I mean, you would start by finding all of the 3 cliques in this graph. You know, there's lots of them. It'll get a mess. And you've kind of got to use your head a bit to say, how are those going to be merged? All right, all of these 3 cliques have a 2 clique in common. And then you get this and this left over. That's a clique percolation with k=3. Clique percolation with k=2. Yeah, so that's kind of it's a trick question almost. Certainly not everyone got this. Clique percolation with k=2 is connected components, right? So a 2 clique is an edge, and you're joining 2 cliques together. You have to have a node in common. So that's exactly the same as the definition of connected components, right? And finally, a little bit of clustering. All right, can you find the 3 clusters in this data that would minimize the reconstruction error? I think you can do it without even reading the question. There they are. So those would be the 3 clusters that would give you the lowest MSE if you replaced each point by a centroid. Next one is just about, okay, what if I wanted to choose between k-means and PCA on this data? Why would I use one rather than the other? Why is PCA perhaps inappropriate? in this case, the data set has no dimension that has a lot more variance than any other dimension, so you're going to lose a lot of information by applying PCA, whereas you would lose not much by running k-means. Okay. And the last question was just about some walking your way through hierarchical clustering. So in what order do the points get merged? You merge A and B, E and F, E, F, and G, A, B, and D. So you get something like this.
And you had to just write down the orders in which clusters are merged and what the clusters look like at each stage.
Okay. That's it for the midterm. I think I still have, I've still got 10 minutes, so I thought I'd run through some of the homework questions that people got the most stuck on before we can all go on our way. So there are about three issues across the two homeworks. They weren't too bad, or at least the second one's not looking too bad for how much we've marked so far. The first thing people were confused about was why, as they increased the degree of that polynomial they were fitting, they didn't see much of a reduction in test error on that equal partition of the two parts of the data. So you'd think, well, degree 2 polynomial or degree 3 polynomial is not exactly complex, right? It's still very low degree. We can't really possibly be overfitting to a model with 4 parameters given 25,000 training examples. So why does it appear not to work? Anyone guess an explanation? It's kind of more boring than it seems. So it's just to do with how we built our training and test sets. So we said the training set is the first 25,000 points. The test set is the the last 25,000 points. Okay, so who knows what X is? Who knows what happened to my data before it arrived in your hands? But if you want your error to transfer well from one data set to another, they ought to have been drawn from the same distribution. And you have no reason to think that's true about this data. I forget exactly how I generated it. I guess I must have sorted it based on some key. So it was sorted based on user ID or something like that, which means that these are totally not independent samples of the data. There's something different about the test set compared to the training set, which means that even a very sensible model, which is not overfit at all on the training set, is just not going to work well on the test set because it's the wrong function, basically. Another question people got stuck on was this one of the training error not decreasing for the support vector machine. So we had this SVM that looked like this. You have C on this axis, and you have the training error on the other axis. So what people kind of expected was that the training error would go down as C increased. So for those who don't remember, C was a little bit different from lambda. It's just the way SVMs are formulated. With regression, you say error plus lambda times complexity. With SVMs, it looks like complexity plus C times error. So that regularizes on the other term. Yeah? I mean, it doesn't matter. The point is, for the SVM, the error goes down as C increases. For the regressor, the lambda goes, I mean, the error goes up as lambda increases. Anyway. I can make that explicit. I mean, this is penalizing training error. And this is penalizing, the error, not the, and this is penalizing complexity. So people were finding, for one, it wasn't really going down all that far. It was asymptoting fairly quickly. This is nothing to be alarmed by. It's just that you're fitting a very, very simple model here. You had a model with only something like 10 parameters, so it just isn't possible to overfit. The most badly overfit model with 25 observations and 10 parameters, it's probably basically the perfect model. So your model just is not expressive enough to fully explain the training data, so it never gets low beyond a point. The other thing is that this curve looked something like this. It was a step function rather than a smooth function, like it was for logistic regression. The reason this happens is because, well, with a support vector machine where we have this, we're just counting the number of errors, right? This is not a continuous function. It's like a step function. So a small change in the parameters does not necessarily change the error. Whereas the logistic regression, it was some likelihood, which is a smooth function. So for SVMs, the error is going to look like a step function, which means that there must be points where changing the parameters doesn't change the error at all. So eventually it's just, it levels off for a long time and nothing happens. Okay, so the third thing people got stuck on was optimizing this reconstruction error with PCA. So, you know, the way I showed this in the slides is that you would take your data, you would find, this is sort of x naught, x1, this is psi naught, psi 1, you'd transform it onto this new basis, and then you would discard a dimension. So it looks like that. And then you would invert, you'd untransform it, and you would, and then you would compute the error. That's one way you could, and this is sort of flat, right? That's one way you could solve this problem. I gave this hint, which said it's a lot easier, and you can just take your data, you can transform, and you can just, this is the transformation, and you can just measure the variance. So you don't need to run the transform, discard a dimension, invert the transform, calculate the MSE. You just run the transform and you say how much variance is left over in the lowest dimensions. Where people got stuck actually is that they would use the library function, always dangerous, PCA.transform. And what does that do? It puts the data here. Shocking, right? So it first of all centers your data so that it has zero mean in every dimension and transforms it that way. So, okay, it's not a big deal. If you measure the variance in this dimension, it's the same. You'll get the right answer. But if what you tried to do then was invert this, you'll end up with data that looks like this. Yeah? And unless you added those mean values back in, the distance between this data and this data looks much larger than the distance between this data and this data. Okay? Anyone got stuck on that one? Yeah, that's going to cost you half a mark, I'm afraid. Yeah. Yeah. I guess inverse transform remembers, it creates a PCA object, right? So inverse transform presumably remembers what the mean values were and adds them back. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, you can read the library function's code. I guess you've got to figure out what the library function's doing that you're not. I'm not sure what that is, though. Yeah? All right, can't quite hear. Sorry.
Still can't quite hear. That sounds correct. I'd have to give that more thought, but yeah. I'd have to give that more thought, but I think that's correct. Okay, maybe that's not the same then. All right. Everyone's a bit restless, obviously, so I think we can call it there and ask me questions down the front. Best of luck on the mid.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.